All right, community podcast listeners, I have a special guest today with me. Maria Lieberman is a PA student that's been working with me, and so we decided to do a joint podcast. And Maria has spent some time looking up some information regarding multiple myeloma, so we're going to discuss that, and then we'll briefly talk as well about a New England Journal article pitting tiotropium versus salmeterol. And so let me hand it over to Maria.
Thank you, and hello. So as we just mentioned, I'm going to be discussing multiple myeloma. Basically, as many of you probably know, multiple myeloma is a proliferation of plasma cells. This proliferation ends up resulting in skeletal destruction, often seen as osteolytic lesions, osteopenia, or pathologic fractures. There can be a wide variety of clinical presentations. Some of those include bone pain due to the lytic lesions. You can have hypercalcemia, which is either symptomatic or discovered incidentally. You can present with increased total serum protein concentration or the presence of monoclonal protein in the urine or serum, which I believe is also known as the Bence-Jones protein. In addition, you can have acute renal failure, and that can be caused by a multitude of different factors. Often one of the most common signs and symptoms of this condition is anemia. An article on UpToDate states that about 73% of patients with multiple myeloma have anemia, and that's consistent with multiple other cancers as well. Other symptoms that I have mentioned include the bone pain and the hypercalcemia, but additional ones also include elevated creatinine, fatigue, generalized weakness, and of course weight loss. As far as the epidemiology, multiple myeloma basically accounts for about 1% of all cancers, although accounts for about 10% of hematologic cancers. When discussing who this type of cancer impacts, the incidence is much more common in African Americans when compared to whites and lower in Asians. Multiple myeloma is occurs slightly more frequently in men. However, as I mentioned, it's not significant. So basically, let me just page through here. And some of the other things I wanted to discuss was the monoclonal proteins that are often, as I mentioned, associated. You can look for proteins in both the serum and the urine. And as I know that I learned, and I'm sure many have as well, the M protein is one that you're especially looking for. You're also going to be looking for the heavy chains or light chains or both. And as far as those proteins, often you're looking for, or often what surfaces, is an elevation in IgG and IgA as well. You can also get kappa or lambda light chains, and the lambda light chains are the ones that I had referred to earlier as Bence-Jones proteins. So as far as how to go about diagnosing this condition, as I mentioned before, the osteolytic lesions are classic. The literature suggests doing a bone survey with plain radiographs and making sure to include the humerus and the femoral bones. And it also states that CTs, MRIs, and PETs are in fact more sensitive than plain radiographs at detecting this bone involvement. However, the clinical importance of those is not clear. Additional things that you might see on those radiographic studies, in addition to the osteolytic lesions, include compression fractures, and even potential spinal cord compression. And the spinal cord compression that is discussed in the literature is actually due to plasma. I don't recall the exact term, but it's essentially a mass of plasma cells.
Yeah, plasmacytoma.
Plasmacytoma.
Yeah.
And that can actually cause, as I mentioned, a spinal cord compression, and they can actually get emergency symptoms of like spinal anesthesia and bowel and bladder dysfunction, things of that nature. Where else would you like to go from here?
You know, were we going to just limit ourselves to the clinical manifestations and diagnosis? Was that, or were we doing, anything else? Because we can always come back on a later podcast.
I mean, we can discuss, you know, the presentation that we recently saw, or I didn't know if you had anything else in mind.
No, that's good. I think, so let's just limit ourselves then to the clinical features and laboratory manifestations and the diagnosis.
Okay.
So I think that that was an excellent overview. I guess the only other things, so hypercalcemia, bone pain, lytic bone lesions, anemia, renal failure. Yep. So those are the things I think about when we talk about multiple myeloma in terms of its presentation. Some of the laboratory features that are sometimes a tip-off in the early stages of diagnosis are an elevated total protein to albumin ratio, because the total protein represents the abnormal proteins produced by plasma cells, like you mentioned. The protein in the urine won't be detected by a standard urinalysis because the protein for the urine is albumin. And the diagnosis is by SPEP, UPEP, and bone marrow, along with skeletal surgery.
I just forgot to mention bone marrow.
Oh, okay, go ahead. Why don't you, did you have anything else to say about the bone marrow?
I mean, I did. Now I just have to find my notes on it, of course. So the bone marrow aspirate and biopsy are actually key components to the diagnosis of multiple myeloma. Typically, once retrieving the bone marrow, the marrow will contain approximately 10% or more of these clonal plasma cells, and obviously that's a tip-off to this diagnosis. There are rare cases that where the biopsy may show less than 10%, but that is in a significant minority of patients. There wasn't much else, just that obviously that's pretty crucial for the diagnosis because, as you know, osteolytic lesions are kind of a symptom of the actual diagnosis, where the bone marrow aspirate, you're actually able to identify those plasma cells themselves.
So I think tip-offs, like when do you think of the diagnosis of multiple myeloma? Anemia, renal failure, renal insufficiency, hypercalcemia, elevated total protein. So in those situations, that's when you would think about a potential diagnosis of multiple myeloma, and then move on to more diagnostic studies. So perhaps in a future podcast, we could go over staging and treatment, and then we could also talk about MGUS, which is monoclonal gammopathy of unknown significance, and how that then plays into multiple myeloma. So let's switch gears and talk about the other article that we found of interest. Every hospitalist should be aware of. So when did this appear? New England Journal, if we want to give credit where credit is due, March 24, 2011, by Vogelmeier, Prevention of the POET COPD Trial. I always love these names. And people can check this out in the New England Journal. So I'll take it away, Maria, just to give us an overview of what they did and what they found, and then we can talk about what the heck do we do with their findings.
Okay. So this article discusses the use of tiotropium versus salmeterol for the prevention of exacerbations of COPD patients. Basically, the article begins by stating that in all the literature, there is, although multiple studies have tried to differentiate which is better, there isn't any clear research that favors a long-acting anticholinergic drug versus a beta-2 agonist. The literature states that both of them are beneficial in preventing these exacerbations. However, because of the size or the weight of the studies, or for numerous other reasons, they haven't actually, prior to this study, been able to identify if there's a significant benefit with one versus the other. So this particular study compared patients. There was actually no placebo group per se, because we already are under the understanding that both, or either or, a long-acting anticholinergic drug or a beta-2 agonist is much more beneficial than a placebo, than nothing at all, essentially. So they basically compared the two and ended up in a randomized, one-year-long, randomized, double-blinded, double-dummy, parallel group trial. They implemented 18 micrograms of tiotropium once daily in one group, and in the second group, they did 50 micrograms of salmeterol twice daily. And one thing to note, in order to make this double-blinded, they ended up having the patients in both groups essentially completing three inhalations of either placebo or the actual drug so that it was in fact blinded. So essentially the results of this study show that tiotropium resulted in increased time to first exacerbation, increased time to first serious exacerbation, decreased number of annual moderate to severe exacerbations. And it also states that as far as the incidence of serious events, they were equal in both groups. There was approximately 64 deaths with the tiotropium group and 78 with the salmeterol group. And that's also, it's also important to keep in mind that in both those numbers, they counted patients that went off the study and potentially stopped taking the drug, things like that. So these numbers, you know, may or may not actually include the true results of the drug itself, more that the dosages and the protocol was not followed. So let's see, what else did I want to mention? So one of the
you know, go ahead. Just real quick.
Yes.
The other thing I think And I'm a little disappointed, to be honest, in the study, and I'm not a, obviously this is a community hospitalist podcast, so I'm not like an academic hospitalist, but they excluded a lot of people. So they excluded people with significant diseases other than COPD. So patients with known symptomatic BPH, patients with MI within the previous year prior to visit, patients with cardiac arrhythmia, severe cardiovascular disease. Mm-hmm. So basically, I like this study. I like that they had a lot of people, but man, these were like, I don't know that I've actually seen somebody this healthy in the hospital in the past 6 months. So they took people with COPD, but it was like a fairly, stage two based on their lung function. Mm-hmm. But then they excluded if you had heart disease or anything, they seem to exclude a lot of people on the basis of these exclusion criteria, whereas I tend to like use it more broadly. So I think it's, the study can only, we can only draw conclusions about the study based on the people who were in it. Although sometimes we try to say, what other conclusions might we be able to draw? But I think that was one of the things that was disappointing. And then, did they have an average age in there? I thought the average, above 40.
Especially in a graph.
People above 40, but I think it was a pretty young,
it looks like they have these three groups that they break it down here is less than 55, greater than 50, well, in between 55 and 65, and then greater than 65. So, I just have these. I don't think they ever once give. Here, wait. Male sex. So, it was one of the other things, it was significantly more men. However, that obviously is associated with the disease condition. But the age here with the tiotropium trial, it looks like 62.9 plus or minus 9. And with the salmeterol, it was 62.8 plus or minus 9.
Okay. So anyway, that's just my little thing about this study.
And that being said, I think they kind of comment at one point in the article about reasons why other articles haven't been able to come up with a clear statement of which alternative is the better option.
Sure.
And I feel like they really tried to get it down to as basic as a situation as we can, so we can really isolate the drug itself,
right.
As opposed to other, comorbidities and/or other potential medications.
Right. So I that's always one of the challenges.
Definitely.
Is, but I think by then narrowing the group of people that they were studying, it narrows the, it makes it difficult to know the applicability. So okay. I think certainly, go ahead, because I don't think we were finished.
I definitely agree with that. And also just the how realistic the information is based on what you were saying as far as other patients having comorbidities. The other thing that I was just going to comment on was they did actually allow the patients to continue inhaled glucocorticoids.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was interesting. They really talked a lot about it and trying to say that regardless of the fact that if a patient had an exacerbation and they needed to go on glucocorticoids, we, for safety and reasons and for medical, of course, because of the issue itself, but they allowed them to continue on those glucocorticoids in both groups, but still were able to isolate for the, drugs that are being compared. So they talked a lot about that because, you know, there was a lot of, and even I believe in the editorials that I read, the author of that, Dr. I'm not going to be able to pronounce it. I should give a go.
Wadzicka. And I've got to apologize to Dr. Wadzicka for butchering his name and he's listening to our podcast.
So he also pointed that out as well. That's just something to kind of be aware of. So.
And I think a lot we're on, what was this highlighted portion you had there?
So he states that an important note about this trial is it was not a direct comparison of long-acting beta agonists and long-acting anticholinergics since the concomitant medications were allowed. More than 50% of the patients were receiving on a regular basis the inhaled glucocorticoids that I have mentioned.
Right. So, I don't know. I mean, I guess stepping back, I think certainly if I had somebody who fit this study criteria, then tiotropium would make sense in terms of lengthening the time to first exacerbation. What we'll have to do is, I've been using this tiotropium in for patients in terms of secondary prevention, and what we should do is kind of look and see if we can find any literature in terms of the secondary prevention. But I've kind of been giving most of the people in the hospital tiotropium and inhaled glucocorticoid, because I think there's some literature in regards to inhaled glucocorticoid. I guess I'm wondering then, should I give them all three, or just two of the three and drop the long-acting beta agonist? So
In the editorial, he also refers to that as well, to just keep in mind that many of these patients are on combinations of all these drugs and how one drug plays into the next and that interaction, and if there is indeed.
Yeah, I'm giving a long-acting, inhaled beta agonist and systemic beta blockers, although the beta blockers are, beta 1, are more blood pressure and heart rate specific, so it does get to be, we're giving people 5 or 6 medications, and that's also another philosophic thing, is that sometimes I wonder, we spend a lot of time thinking one medicine versus the other, and maybe people would be better if we picked our top 5 of the 30 medicines we have them to take. Because how much additional benefit do they get from medicines 7 through 10? And I have to believe that compliance starts to go down. Compliance has to wane significantly. I don't know, I thought this was interesting. It's a kind of prize to get at these two drugs head to head. I think, in practice, from the hospital setting, when people come in with an exacerbation, I tend to send them home on an inhaled glucocorticoid, an inhaled beta agonist, and tiotropium. I'm not entirely sure if they need all three, and I'm not sure which one of them would be the first to go.
One other thing I did want to ask, you had mentioned using it as secondary prevention. So in this study, they actually, as part of the inclusion criteria, they actually state that there has to have been a documented history of at least one exacerbation leading to treatment with systemic glucocorticoids or antibiotics,
okay,
or if they were hospitalized in the previous year. So in a way, they actually are using it as secondary prevention.
Good point. That's why you're on the podcast, Maria.
I wouldn't go that far.
that's the standard we have.
Good point. The article, as you pointed out, it has a its good points, and it has its...
No, that's absolutely, all these articles have strengths and weaknesses. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think that my, you know, I think it'd be nice to see, you know, I don't know what the article that you would like to see, but I guess I'd like to see sicker people included to know if the medicine is making a difference. But, or maybe people who have frequent exacerbations. But we should look more and see what the background literature is. So, but that's a good point of them having one exacerbation, so, in the past. So an interesting article. Well, thank you again, podcast listeners. And if there are any questions or comments about this or any of the previous podcast, I can be reached at my email, dan.valanchis@gmail.com. Thank you.